Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. We're in a slightly different set, as you may have observed. We are at CPAC in Dallas, Texas. And one of the wonderful things about these conclaves is that they attract some of the most important, some of the most interesting, some of the most impactful people in the country. And we're going to be talking with one of them for this first two blocks of the program today. His name is Dr. Robert Malone. If you have been, well, alive, I guess, as well as paying any attention at all, since COVID-19 sprung upon us, you know that he is one of the most formidable medical doctors and practitioners of healthcare who has engaged in the effort to understand what we really are confronting here and what needs to be done to save our country from the effects of not just the virus, but the vaccines that have been, well, so-called vaccines that have been forced upon us in response to the so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus. Dr. Malone is the author of the forthcoming book, Lies My Government Told Me and the Better Future Ahead. I am honored to have him with us, and thank you for taking a few minutes to bring us up to speed on your thinking about the problems that we're facing in your part of the battle space, sir. Welcome back.
Always my pleasure.
So let's level set a little bit, because again, people who have been following your work, I think, understand some of your most important insights. You were one of the people who developed the whole mRNA technology that is now at the core of these gene therapies, so-called vaccines. But you've been warning about not only the better ways that we could be treating this virus than these so-called vaccines, and some of the real hazards associated with the vaccine. So give us a short course on all of that, if you would.
So it became clear early on to many physicians, including the group that I was leading on behalf of Department of Defense, working under a variety of different contract vehicles, working on repurposed drugs, that there were a number of agents and strategies that could be used to treat this disease, which is really fairly mild, unless you're in one of the very high-risk groups. Now, I don't want to make it sound like this is just nothing. And I was infected in the first wave of Wuhan 1, unclear whether it was a client from China who had just come back, who had a cold at the time, a young woman, or was it that I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when the original outbreak hit there in Boston, going to a conference. But in any case, when I got infected, it certainly threw me for a loop and damaged my ability to work and be productive, be on the farm. So I don't want to minimize the disease, but the truth is that the mortality is all clustered in people that have these high-risk categories like obesity, diabetes, and old age. Much the same, it overlaps quite a bit with the mortality associated with influenza, which tends to be also an old person's disease. Yeah. So it's not influenza, but it's not a highly lethal pathogen like, say, Ebola. And yet it was promoted in many ways and advanced as if it was a highly pathogenic virus. And there was a strange concerted effort on the part of multiple federal agencies to block early treatments and repurposed drugs. And we know details are coming out more and more about that effort to block the ability of patients to be able to have access to life-saving treatment with basically generic, inexpensive drugs.
Early treatment,
because the information is coming out, like the video interview of Rick Bright that the former Zev Zelenko had circulated, in which Rick Bright basically acknowledged that he had conspired with Janet Woodcock to block the availability of hydroxychloroquine in the general population in direct contrast to the direction that he had received from the President of the United States. And then we saw the propaganda and attacks on ivermectin and so many other agents.
And the doctors who, like yourself, were saying this could be useful.
And anybody that spoke about this has been severely attacked. You, I don't know if your viewers are familiar with my good friend, Dr. Ryan Cole. Mm-hmm. Ryan is a highly experienced, highly trained pathologist who came out early also, notorious for the one of his early statements. He called this the clot shot because it causes coagulation, and that coagulation often kills people when it happens, and certainly damages them.
And not
them.
Necessarily just in those clustered groups, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Young people, etc. Ryan just wrote to me. He has been run out of business. He had licenses in, I think, 5 or 6 different states, running the largest pathology practice in the Northwest. And through all of the attacks in the press and the slander and the defamation, and that's triggered multiple states to withdraw his medical license and multiple insurance clients to no longer allow recharge for his business, he now has to sell off his business. He's not sure what he's going to do with his life. This has been his entire life.
He's done very well at it.
Up until now, ran a huge business. Never had any complaints about quality or anything. And then, of course, my friend Peter McCullough has had a shocking story in terms of the defamation, attacks, slander, lawsuits, etc., that he's had to sustain. Pierre Corey,
and again, trying
Paul
to take
Merrick,
licenses away. And
trying to take his license away, as has happened with many others. The physician, a lovely, elderly physician that's been practicing for decades, who suggested that I take ivermectin for my chronic long COVID symptoms, Meryl Nass, lost her license. That it's what has been done to the practice of medicine and to physicians has been shocking. But people are often, I hear all the time, how come the other docs aren't speaking out? Well, they're looking around and they're seeing the leaders who have spoken out being subjected to this, losing their licenses, losing their practices. Of course they're laying low. Right. They don't have any choice. And I hear stories all the time of physicians that have, the other day I heard one of a physician's board for a doc that had supported the early treatment agenda and raised concerns about the vaccines, having received a direct letter from his licensing board that they were watching him, and he better not say anything publicly about his opinions or they would take away his license. There's direct threats. It's shocking what's going on.
This is canceling, and it's state-sponsored. It's not just being done by individuals.
It's hard. Yeah, it is state-sponsored in some cases, but it's hard to discern what is the puppet master, what's the hand behind this. And strangely, it often seems that these organizations that are doing this canceling have strong financial ties with the pharmaceutical industry, and almost always,
I'm shocked,
there's strong ties with the company called Pfizer.
Hold this thought. Dr. Robert Malone is in the house, not virtually, but actually here with us at CPAC in Dallas, Texas. We're going to talk more with him about Big Pharma and what it has been doing to not just docs, but to patients, to our healthcare system, and frankly, to our country. All of that and much more with Dr. Robert Malone, the author of a new book, Lies, My Government Told Me, coming soon.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute, Congressional Democrats have cynically adopted a deceptively entitled Inflation Reduction Act. It would be more accurate to call it the Help China Win Act. Americans will suffer, and the Chinese Communist Party will benefit, as independent economists say inflation will be undiminished, notably devastating defense spending. Moreover, the act will advance the CCP's agenda of destroying the United States by moving us towards a police state, by upgunning literally and weaponizing the IRS against Americans, reducing our energy security by further assaulting coal and increasing renewables supply chain dependencies on China, and making massive new expenditures that undermine the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Unfortunately, such effects are not isolated events. They are of a piece with the Biden administration's larger wrecking operation that hurts our country to the benefit of our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. This is Frank Afton.
Welcome back. We are continuing a conversation with one of the men I admire most in the world. His name is Dr. Robert Malone. He has been an extraordinarily courageous champion for public health, real public health, in the face of adversity, as we heard in the previous segment, emanating from medical practitioners and associations, as well as the government, a lot of which seems to be emanating, though, from the pharmaceutical industry, which I think we're going to hear more about the role it is playing in what has been described as regulatorily captured oversight agencies like the Federal Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Malone, you started off in this conversation by talking a bit about what has happened to the practice of medicine in all of this. Talk a bit about the role that the pharmaceutical industry is playing, not only in, well, the practice of medicine, but also the practice of journalism, the practice of regulating the food and drug industries, including, of course, Big Pharma.
It's really difficult to untangle the various threads by which pharmaceutical industry is influenced the United States and by extension the rest of the Western world. And I think that one of the keys to comprehending this is to recognize that there was a period in time not so long ago when the pharmaceutical industry was prohibited from direct advertising and also had regulations in the United States placed upon it in terms of what it could charge. And that those policies were changed at the time when there was some negotiations between Senator Edward Kennedy, one of the leading proponents of healthcare systems and what we call Obamacare now, and the company called Novartis. And my friends from Switzerland tell me, I was not aware of this previously, that there were these meetings between the senator and Novartis leadership. Then there were these changes in the law that allowed the pharmaceutical industry to directly market in the United States. For the rest of the world, they're prohibited from running these advertisements on TV and radio, etc.
Is that right?
Okay, this is something only in the United States.
Wow.
And in most of the world, they have constraints on what they can charge in terms of their cost and profit margins. But in the United States, those were thrown out apparently as part of some sort of a quid pro quo deal. And it's noted by my Swiss friends, who Novartis relocated from Switzerland to, wait for it, Boston, Massachusetts, the senator's home state. And that kind of catalyzed a lot of the Boston biotech miracle, but at a cost that we're all paying, I believe, which is that the pharmaceutical industry now has become a monster. It's generated so much cash that it functionally capitalizes our elections all the way down to school boards. There's so much revenue there that they are able to move that and influence public policy from the level of the executive branch all the way down to local school boards.
There is an irony that I can't help but note that Edward Kennedy's nephew, Bobby Kennedy Jr., is, I believe, one of the most vociferous critics of what has happened
and
here
as
with
you know,
the pharmaceutical
Bobby,
industry.
So Bobby is a personal hero of mine. You said that you thought I was a personal hero, and I'm grateful
you
for
are.
That. I don't know that I've earned it yet.
Oh, indeed,
it's only been
have.
A couple of years. We'll see the long term. Bobby has, so RFK Jr., has truly been an amazing American fighting for truth and honesty. He's labeled as an anti-vaxxer, but the honest truth is that he's seeking answers to the fundamental questions: have these vaccine products been adequately tested in our children? And has the risk of these interacting together in this compressed vaccine schedule been evaluated? And as he's dug down through that question, he's had all kinds of invective thrown at him, all kinds of gaslighting.
Suppressing fire.
Yeah, and labeled as this pejorative anti-vaxxer.
Denier.
So all of these things. As the truth has emerged, it's become increasingly clear that there aren't the data to support the safety and effectiveness, particularly in vaccines in combination in their pediatric population.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about this specifically, and we're going to run out of time before there's all the questions answered, but they're no longer even making any pretense of doing testing. The FDA these days is now saying, well, if you're just modifying these vaccines that have been previously approved,
so that's,
you can sort of dispense with
So there's
testing.
So many things here that are kind of really pretty shocking to somebody who's an expert in this area.
The shocking extension, a layperson,
yeah,
I have to
so,
say, too.
So the logic here is that we do something like this with the traditional influenza vaccines. And so reasoning by analogy, why don't we do it with this new vaccine technology that remains unlicensed? Okay, it is what to get to the core, do we have the receipts on the influence of Pfizer and Moderna on the FDA? And the answer is yes. They most recently have come in the form of the Freedom of Information Act acquired emails surrounding the resignation of Marion Gruber and her colleague, very influential lead regulators on vaccines at the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research under the FDA. And those emails reveal that the reason why those two resigned was because of the undue influence of the White House and Pfizer and Moderna advocating for allowance to proceed with the boosters, which we now know the boosters are damaging people's immune systems.
Yeah.
That's why they resigned, and that is the smoking gun documenting this undue influence. There is no way, historically, that Pfizer and Moderna should have been able to directly influence the decision-making and evaluation process within the FDA. And it confirms all of our suspicions.
Continue to do so. At this point, with as much problems.
Their complaint was that there was undue pressure coming from the White House as well as pharma. But you can bet the pressure from the White House was coming from pharma.
You bet.
Okay, so yeah.
Everybody's got a piece of this, including all of the journalists who are or publications
who are working for companies who are capitalized
too.
By the pharmaceutical
Pfizer.
Industry because we have Congress enabled direct advertising.
Yeah.
I think that if you want to do root cause analysis, it comes back to there's so much money floating in the system right now because of that fundamental decision.
When you look at this in the aggregate, is there any hope that we can rectify this situation? You talk in your subtitle of your new book, and I do want to give you a chance to just say something about Substack as well, where people can find your writings in
So
the
is there any chance? So we did a couple of Substacks, and it's in the book. They were chapters for the book about what to do with the problem of HHS. And it's a two-part. The first part is examination of the underlying problems, and it has to do with the administrative state, how the administrative state's been structured, empowered, the laws that support it. and then all of the associated corruption that involves the revolving door and everything else associated with that. Is there anything we can do about it? My best hope, paradoxically, comes from the ruling of West Virginia versus EPA, and the Supreme Court now clearly being committed to confronting the administrative state. And for the real root cause problem here is that Congress is not willing to do its job and actually legislate.
Do the legislation.
And so what they do is they pass the buck to the senior executive service that actually makes policy and laws now.
The permanent
and they're unelected.
Government. We're going to have to leave it at that. Dr. Robert Malone, thank you for your insights as always and for your courage in expressing them. We're going to continue this conversation with him, I hope, in the near future. But in the meantime, we're going to turn to economic warfare and what's being done to wage against us with our friend Kevin Freeman of the Economic War Room right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversations here at the Dallas CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference at the Hotel Anatole, and marvelous people are walking about, and it's always a privilege to be able to snag one or two of them to visit with us about issues that are of supreme importance to those of us who care about our country and protecting it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. One of them, who is with us at the moment, I'm very pleased to say, is one of America's best pollsters. His name is John McLaughlin of John McLaughlin and Associates, a very, very important firm, particularly in conservative political circles. Donald Trump has taken advantage of John's services, among many others, as has the Center for Security Policy. And our Committee on the Present Danger, China, recently asked John to do some polling as part of a national poll conducted in late July about China. And I wanted to talk to him a little bit about some of the results of those questions that he posed and what they mean particularly for what I think is the principal point of this book, which we published in July as well. It's called The CCP is at War with America. And our earnest hope is to ensure that elected officials or would-be elected officials this fall will be asked about the findings of this book and more generally about what the public thinks of China and the need for a course correction in terms of our defense of our country against the Chinese Communist Party threat. John, it's good to have you with us.
Frank,
again, thank you for your service to our country in so many ways, as
I
well as your help in finding out what the American people think.
Right.
The poll that we asked your help with had four questions in particular that I wanted to see if you could elaborate on a little bit. One was about this, the biological warfare attack that the Chinese Communist Party, we found, deliberately unleashed in the form of this COVID-19 pandemic by allowing people from Wuhan to come to this country and other parts of the world. Your poll found that 60% of those surveyed believe that the Chinese did do that deliberately and it did constitute this kind of an attack. Were you surprised?
No, and that poll is of 1,000 likely voters. These are not just any adults or any
people walking around the street.
It's meant to get a focus on the November elections. So it's 1,000 voters who said they're likely to vote on November 8th, and they definitely have a feeling that China did this deliberately in terms of they covered it up, they didn't tell us the facts, they didn't let the world know. And it's more likely to be among Republicans, although Democrats and Biden voters are split on this, 43-39, where they really think, even the Biden voters, think that there was a deliberate, you know, attempt by China to cover up what was going on, let the United States and the rest of the world suffer, and China would somehow be insulated from this or wouldn't face the wrath of American public opinion.
They could get away with it, in other words.
And the majority of voters.
And the interesting thing was, in another answer to a question about whether they should be held accountable for it, you got a very similar result.
It's virtually the same. It's 6 out of 10 voters, 2-1 majority. And you can see Republican candidates, because almost half the voters are less likely to vote for a candidate on this if they're soft on China, if they don't want to hold China accountable. And the Republicans correctly, and Democrats should join them. There should be hearings on this.
No question.
People need to know. Unlike China, which doesn't allow free speech, they don't have pollsters doing the same kind of public opinion surveys in China. Americans think we need to get to the bottom of this, figure out what happened. Because, hey, there's damages to be done.
No
there
doubt about
lost
it.
Lives.
Yeah. And a million of them, roughly, or so, just in this country alone. And John, you know, one of the things I'm always interested in, because it is often asked, is you go to very considerable lengths to try to make sure that you're not only picking up 1,000 voters, but you're picking up a representative sample of likely voters. Speak to that sample set and what you found when you set out to get Republicans, get Democrats. What was the balance that you sought to strike?
By the way, it's modeled after the 2020 turnout.
The actual turnout in the national elections.
And 51% of the voters we spoke to did vote for Biden in the election. And there's a point more Democrats than Republicans, 37, 36. So it does really, you know, reflect the exit polls from 2020. Now, granted, it'll be a midterm election. There could be a skew in either party's favor. Yeah. But chances are it's going to be a big turnout like it was in 2018 or 2020. So
maybe bigger.
And by the way, the other part is we only talk to registered voters. Mm. And then we screen them how likely they are to vote in November.
To actually vote.
If they tell us they're not going to vote, we don't talk to them.
Yeah. So you had more Democrats than Republicans, and you were still getting these kinds of results.
More Biden voters.
And more Biden voters. Let me ask you about one of the other findings, and that is you had a question to them about, have you or your family been personally affected by this pandemic, this biological attack? And we found that 70% said they had. I was kind of surprised that it was that low, John, because I thought everybody's been affected some extent, and adversely mostly.
I think, you know, when you say affected, it meant in a very significant way where they lost a loved one or they may have
lost their jobs, lost income.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that is a high number, but it's also changed voting attitudes. Because you're looking at now 21st century voters. We now have voters that were born in this century that are voting in this century.
Right.
And at the same time, you're having voters who didn't have something so defining, like generationally, people will say, remember where you were when
Kennedy got shot
during the Vietnam War. Where were you when, you know, in effect, when 9/11 happened? Now you have this pandemic has generationally affected a lot of voters.
Yes.
And it's defined them. And we're looking at a world where we have a war going on that's significant in Europe, affecting a lot more, and people are really concerned significantly that you could have a world war.
Yes.
They survived a global pandemic. They had economic challenges that they didn't have before, where there were shutdowns. They've now come out of it. And most Americans think the economy's getting worse. They think the country's on the wrong track. Yeah. This is not a good environment right now for public opinion. And voters want to change things.
Well, I want to get to that point, because we also asked the question as to whether or not how a candidate addressed China.
Right.
Presumably to your liking, would affect your vote. Would it be important, very important, a consideration? And the finding there, when you aggregated people who said, yeah, it would matter to me, who would, I guess, be saying it's a voting issue for me, it was 76%,
right,
which is a really strong number.
And China's moved. We used to pick up in our polls that they were an adversary. Most Americans now think China is an enemy.
Yes.
And as
rightly
we
so.
Speak, you didn't get invited to go with Speaker Pelosi to Taiwan.
I did not.
But as we speak, you know, the United States is apparently so weak that when the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who didn't bring any Republicans, wasn't bipartisan, but on her own, went to Taiwan, the Chinese decided to surround Taiwan with ballistic missiles.
Live fire exercises and overflights of ballistic missiles.
Yeah. Now, that's something
it's ominous.
The crazy North Korean dictator used to do, that Donald Trump and Japan had to deal with.
Right.
Now, they've done it, you know, to Taiwan, that relies on us to help them out, and they're not afraid, which is a scary thought.
John, as a highly regarded pollster, you know better than I that typically we're told there are only four things that people think are voting issues in a given election. You know, it's inflation today, I guess it's education, it's, you know, that may be healthcare, other things. How does something, a finding like the one that we just talked about, 76% saying this was be important to me in deciding who to vote for, or at least a consideration. Where does that fit in, and how do you square the fact that it doesn't turn up when those four are typically identified?
Well, it does. Because, first of all, inflation, supply chain disruptions, et cetera.
It's all related.
Most voters know that's coming from China.
Yeah.
Secondly, security. They realize that the United States is insecure in the world. Ever since President Biden surrendered Afghanistan, there's been a national insecurity that's a factor.
Right.
And you also have things that, when we talk about our southern border being invaded, fentanyl's coming from someplace.
It is.
And it's coming from
China. Exactly.
And
right.
Most Americans know somebody in their community that may have lost a loved one because of this, and it's affecting our youth, and it's affecting the security of the country.
Yeah. All key points.
Yeah.
We hope we'll have your help in doing what we call the brief, educating candidates about the fact that the Chinese Communist Party is at war with us and that we must respond appropriately. John McLaughlin, thank you for your leadership and helping in so many ways get this message through. It's vital, and we appreciate you, sir, both as a friend and as a very valued colleague.
Well, thank you.
We'll be right back with more of Securing America right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Congressional Democrats have cynically adopted a deceptively entitled Inflation Reduction Act. It would be more accurate to call it the Help China Win Act. Americans will suffer, and the Chinese Communist Party will benefit, as independent economists say inflation will be undiminished, notably devastating defense spending. Moreover, the act will advance the CCP's agenda of destroying the United States by moving us towards a police state, by upgunning literally and weaponizing the IRS against Americans, reducing our energy security by further assaulting coal and increasing renewables supply chain dependencies on China, and making massive new expenditures that undermine the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Unfortunately, such effects are not isolated events. They are of a piece with the Biden administration's larger wrecking operation that hurts our country to the benefit of our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are visiting here at CPAC in Dallas, Texas, with an American patriot, an American hero, a man who served his country in Vietnam, was shot down over the skies of North Vietnam, and wound up in the Hanoi Hilton for six years, as I recall.
Six years.
His name is Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. He is the author of a book, The Spirit to Soar. We're going to talk with him a little bit about the book, his experiences, his insights from all that he suffered and lived through, and also his insights into where we are today with what's being done to the United States military, not by some foreign enemy, but by our own government. Colonel, it's good to have you here, sir, at Securing America. Thank you so much for joining us.
My honor.
Let's talk a little bit about just your experiences, both in the run-up to your captivity and what you experienced during it, what you took away from it all.
Okay. Sounds good. Starting with my shoot down, I was in a flight of four F-4 Phantoms. We were headed into the downtown Hanoi area to take out railheads and various other military targets. And I was carrying that day a new QRC-160 pod, which is designed to jam the guidance signal of the Fansong radar. And that radar is the way they guide their SA-2 missiles to hit our aircraft. And so we had a new way of jamming it so we didn't have to worry about it. And we were told, when you turn it on, if it doesn't come up, then you've got to fly up close to your element leader and let his jam for both of you. When I got home 6.5 years later, they had a big briefing that said, if you lose your QRC-165, don't fly up next to your element leader. He will double the reflected energy, be detected, and you will be shot down, duh. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, I hate that.
But anyway, I was hit by a missile, and it knocked the tail off, the right wing off, and half the left wing. And all the taillight panels came on, all the cautions about you're burning, your left engine is on fire, your right engine is overheating, you need to service your hydraulic reservoir. Every light you can imagine came on, including one I like. You're in deep chemistry. Yeah. So.
Eject.
And so I ejected. And that all by itself is an incredible story, because you're sitting in a seat with a drogue that's stabilizing the seat. You're going through layers of clouds until you hit 10,000 feet altitude, and then the sensor is supposed to work and kick you out of the seat, deploy your main chute, and you float to the ground. So I went through all of that, except
sensor.
The deployment of me never happened. I'm sitting there looking, and I'm going through decks of clouds, boom, 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 headed to the ground. And I know I ejected at 24,000 feet, and I keep looking at the decks of clouds I'm headed into, and the chute is still not deployed. And I'm saying to myself, there's going to be dirt in one of those sets of clouds. On sensor don't work a heck with this. I'm going to go out manually. So I pull the handle, and it kicked me away from the main seat, and I had to deploy my own parachute. And I landed in downtown Hanoi, pretty close to the prison. So that's where it all started, and then my new life began in the prison system. Now, one thing that's important, the missile that hit my aircraft hit my helmet, shattered it. You see the cut. And blood poured all over my face, all over my body. And I said to myself, I bet I can parlay this. I got blood into I can't see, and they may think, well, he's not worth fooling with. And so I started that before I ever hit the ground. And boy, did I play that for everything it was worth for all those years. We were all playing games of any kind we could come up with, but that was one that I used very successfully.
So this was part of the preparation for a very tough 6 years, obviously.
Yes, it's part of the preparation.
And you mentioned before we began recording that you were subjected to the penalty camp treatment, which meant that you had obviously incurred the wrath of your captors.
Oh, yeah.
And they meted out even worse treatment than you got in just the general.
That lasted for years. For years, you were constantly going to the torture tank.
Wow.
And we had people knocking eardrums out, doing all kinds of things. And till about 1971, 65 to about 71 was brutal. About 71, they started changing. This was in the aftermath of the Santé raid. I guess they thought, well, we might want to quit at some point. We might want to slow down. But anyway, they did.
So it got a little bit better, but you were nonetheless still being horribly treated.
The prison cell was 114 degrees. You were blood coming out of your body, bleeding constantly from that. And the people were having trouble breathing. They had medical issues. It was terrible.
And throughout, as I understand it, standard operating procedure was to try to get you to disavow your country.
Oh, and, absolutely.
You know, essentially.
Yeah, and we were
turn
all
colors.
Yeah, and we were all fighting our individual battles on how to deal with that.
I bet.
The interrogator, crazy loon, but you wouldn't want to be in front of this guy. And he looks at me, and they had two MiG-21 pilots sitting there. And he says, you must tell us how fast the F-4 can fly. I said, it is very fast. And he says something to his buddies, and they come back to ask the dummy how fast. So he comes back to you must tell us how fast. I said, the F-4. I said, I am a junior pilot, not allowed to fly fast. That worked. I probably wouldn't let him fly fast.
So, their experience, I'm sure.
You were tempted to play.
I bet.
I bet.
Colonel Bridger, we're going to have to take a break.
When
we come back, I'm anxious to get your thoughts because I know that you lived the virtues of a military officer in Vietnam. Whether those virtues are now being
eroded.
Greatly eroded,
or
if not essentially vaporized, by what's being done to the United States military by the Biden administration. We'll talk about that with this war hero, the author of The Spirit to Soar, The Inspiring Life Lessons and Values for a Victorious Life. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. We're having a very moving conversation with a patriot who suffered terribly at the hands of his North Vietnamese captors. He was in the Hanoi Hilton and in other garden spots of North Vietnam being punished for not conforming to their dictates for some 6 years. Obviously, one of the things that got him through that was a love of our country and a conviction about our military and its values. And I wanted to ask Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger, United States Air Force retired, to talk a little bit about what his take is on the assault on those same values, those same military virtues that seem to be part and parcel of what the Biden administration is doing to our armed forces today. And Colonel, I know you've got some views on this subject. You're obviously following the stories about the critical race theory, the Marxist indoctrination of our military, the purges that are being done if you don't conform, the vaccine mandates now that are forcing people to take the jab even when it will quite possibly harm them rather than help them. What do you make of what's going on here? I've come to the conclusion that it's the cultural Marxism of Mao, basically, that is being used to take down one of the last institutions of our country. But I'm anxious to get your thoughts on it, sir.
The question our veterans encounter the most often is this: what, pray tell, would I have done under the brutal pressure of combat, the brutal pressure of serious physical or psychological injury, or the brutal pressure of a POW camp? The answer, of course, would have been predetermined, in my judgment, by the values you brought to the fight. My ancestors, our ancestors, brought us out of Hanoi. I was absolutely amazed and incredibly proud of the people around me who were suffering, many of them, in unbelievable ways. Some of them actually killed, murdered, right there in the prison system. And I was raised early in my life as an orphan. I was an orphan for unwed mothers, and by the grace of God, I was adopted at about 5 years of age by an incredible family. When you talk about values, my brother was a World War II pilot flying with Barry Goldwater in the hump, doing things that extraordinary skill was required to do. And I couldn't have had a better role model about the importance of banding together to overcome tough times. Tough times are there. I also would point out, we were busy as because people think you're just stuck in the cell somewhere, nothing's going on. Nothing could be further from the truth. We were just doing all kinds of things to help people who couldn't breathe, people who were being brutally treated, people who had problems like boils and stuff. And of course, we were all, I weighed 114 pounds at one time. And so we're dealing with that as well. And then when we weren't dodging the torture chamber, we were looking for something to do that would give us some positive feedback. We had a competition, physical competition. One kid did 2,000 push-ups without stopping. One kid did 5,000 sit-ups without stopping. I did one-hand handstands. Then if you looked at all the calculus and the other math issues that we used to stimulate our minds, I guarantee you there's nothing timid about us trying to find ways to get things done and make a difference in the lives of our fellow POWs and being extraordinarily impressed and proud to be part of that group.
That was born, I think you're saying, of the culture in which you were raised.
It was. It absolutely
and
was.
The society from which you came. Do you fear that there is less of that today? I'm reminded, of course, of the episode in which some Navy sailors were captured by the Iranians. And within, hours, they were essentially denouncing our country and singing the praises of their captors. And it seems as though that sort of speaks to the problem that you've just put your finger on. And
I can only imagine how much worse it is today.
I am not only troubled by what I see around me every day. When people are attacked on a street in a huge metropolitan area and potentially murdered or badly beaten, it is inconceivable. I cannot begin to relate to that.
And what it says about our society. And how about the military itself, sir? Are you following still what is happening in the armed forces?
Couldn't be more disappointed.
And the military leadership in particular?
They need to leave.
It's not just the civilians, it's the top
whole
brass.
The package needs to get down. I don't know how feasible that is to some degree, but it is troublesome beyond words to me, what I see going on around me. And so what I have had to do is redouble my efforts to make sure the importance of what you value about life, about living, about me and my kids, no cold, absolutely without any equivocation.
I'm going to flog this book one more time. I've just called my own attention that it's actually authored by Jim Peterson. It's your story.
It's my story.
That he's talked about, The Spirit to Soar, Inspiring Life Lessons and Values for a Victorious Life. A remarkable story of a remarkable man. I want to thank you, sir, for both your service during those difficult times and that you're obviously continuing to provide our country, because your experiences, your values, and your commitment to our country is really, truly an inspirational one, and one that I think is desperately needed, I'm sure, by our men and women in uniform today, but also for the civilians like myself who strongly support them. We're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, Colonel. I appreciate you being here. And thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us do just that, and that you will, informed by what you've learned today, go forth and multiply.